Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today I am really happy to welcome my friend James Howard Kunstler as a guest to the program. Jim's a well-known author and social critic whose ideas have been extremely influential to myself, the Peak Oil and Sustainable Living movements, and other places besides. His best-known works include The Long Emergency, which certainly turned my head a while ago, in which he argues that declining oil production will result in the decline of modern industrialized society and compel Americans to return to smaller-scale, localized, semi-agrarian communities. That was the logical, fact-based book, World Made by Hand, and its sequel, The Witch of Hebron, use fiction to entertainingly transport us into what that future narrative might look and feel like. That is, a world with less net energy. And now there's a brand new book, Too Much Magic, which I hope we're going to discuss today. And, of course, he has an excellent weekly blog found over at Kunstler.com. Jim, I'm so happy to be with you today.
And it's always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris.
Thanks. So, Too Much Magic, the title of your new book. Let's start there. What's that referring to?
Well, it's referring to this period of time, this weird, peculiar period in American history when the delusional thinking has just risen to astronomical levels, predictably, really, in response to the stress levels that our society feels. And it's expressing itself as sort of waiting for Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy to deliver a set of rescue remedies to us, so that we can continue running Walmart, Walt Disney World, Suburbia, the U.S. Army, and the Interstate Highway System by other means. That's the great wish out there. It's kind of understandable because, you know, that's the stuff that we have, and people tend to defend the stuff that they have in any given society and the systems that the platforms that they run on. But it's probably a form of collective behavior that's not really going to benefit us very much and really amounts to simply wasting our time and wasting our dwindling resources and even our spiritual resources when we could be doing things that are a lot more intelligent.
Well, this delusion, this certainly doesn't seem to me to be constrained to any particular side of the social spectrum, political spectrum, to any one religion. It seems to be fairly broad-based, just grossly speaking, left versus right. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. You know, the uniform distribution of delusional thinking is really striking. And, you know, the most striking thing about our predicament right now is our absolute inability to collectively tell ourselves a coherent story about where we're at and what we're going to do about it. We just cannot construct a narrative or a consensus that is consistent with reality. And, you know, hence most of the talk that comes out of any public conversation tends to be loony and unrealistic and rather silly.
You know, it's when you run the numbers, there's this great blog called Do the Math by Tom Murphy, a physics professor, and he had this very nice conversation with an economist, which he captured, and basically the economist was of the view, listen, we're going to have growth forever. And he said, okay, well, just sake of argument, if we just grow our energy use by 3% per year, you realize that in 400 years, the surface temperature of the Earth is boiling point of water because of just the waste heat generated by constantly compounding our energy use. The waste heat that can't escape into space fast enough cooks us. So would you agree somewhere between here and there, maybe, we're going to have to not grow our energy use? There's simple math underlying this. And when I look around the world, you know, and I get to interact with younger and younger people in my audiences, I'm interested to hear your take on this. But also when I went and talked with people at, say, Occupy Wall Street, there are a lot of young people who've looked into this narrative and said, I don't get it. Like, this is fundamentally broken. So I've personally seen that there are cracks in this narrative, this delusion, as it were, that in my perspective, is actually growing.
Well, you know, the late and great Joe Badgent used to refer to this collective imagination as the hologram.
Yeah.
you know, as you know, a sort of a picture of reality that seemed to be there, but really was a mirage. You know, was just simply an image projected in the space of our, you know, whatever our collective mind space is as a society. I forgot what was part B of that.
Well, it's something around the idea that there are more and more growing numbers of people who can see the hologram for what it is, that there are cracks appearing in this.
Right. Well, you know, I think that the part of this that is the most evident nowadays is the connection between our energy predicament and the impairment of capital formation, which I believe is going to really sort of, the capital formation issue is already overtaking the energy issue, even though the energy predicament has not gone away. But what we're discovering more and more is that the world is comprehensively broke in every sphere and in every dimension and in every way. The governments at every level are all broke. The households are going broke. The banks are insolvent. The money really isn't there. And the pretense that the money is there has been kept going simply with accounting fraud. And accounting fraud really accounts for most of the innovation, the so-called innovation that we chatter about. You know, we talk incessantly about, I mean, this is at the heart of too much magic and the wishful thinking about technology. We're so intoxicated with this idea that we can create new and wonderful things. And we have absolutely no sense that the new and wonderful things that we created in the money system are destroying the money system.
Right. Well, there is always this delusion that that it's sort of an addictive behavior, which says that, well, you know, the alcohol was really not working for me all that well anymore. You know, I kind of ran that out. But now that I've moved to heroin, I find that, you know, things are much easier. And eventually the heroin runs out in terms of its ability to provide an impact. And so one of the things that's most strikingly missing from this conversation is not that technology can't play a role to help us mitigate some of these things, but to also acknowledge that with every single technological, and I'm putting air quotes up, improvement that we've managed to deliver to ourselves, there have been concomitant issues that came with them. Technology is not this wonderful thing that solves all problems. It invariably creates new ones. So, you know, the Green Revolution was a technological solution that was great, and it delivered to us 7 billion people, which is going to have a whole host of things that we're going to have to manage. So in this discussion, I found whether it's on the left side with these green alternative technologies that are going to save us, or on the right, we're just going to drill and, you know, unlock, you know, there'll always be more oil to be found somewhere. In neither of those scenarios do I have this sense that we're having the larger conversation, which is yes, and what else might come with that?
Well, this can simply be described as the diminishing returns of technology, or the unintended consequences, or both. And, you know, what it means is that technology turns around and bites you on the ass. And my favorite example of this is the 30-year effort that we made to computerize every phone system in America in order to improve communication. And the net effect of that was that it's now almost impossible to get a live human being on the phone anywhere in America. And the secondary effect of that is that every night when you're sitting down to dinner, a robot calls you to pitch some kind of a product or a political candidate. So, you know, after all that effort to bring technological innovation to telephones, we're left with having conversations with robots.
And, you know? And that's not a huge leap forward in your mind?
No, and you know, because I've been a little preoccupied with medicine for the last 2 months, you know, it's most visible in these places that you would think would be absolutely crucial for live human beings to intervene. Namely, you call up a doctor, and what do you get? You get a phone tree. You know, I mean, it's just the blowbacks from this are hideous, but they're everywhere. You know, it's not just the phone system. You know, obviously the banking system has literally committed suicide, but with technological innovation.
Absolutely. So let's go there for a minute. In Too Much Magic, which I guess at its heart is talking about how we have a delusional narrative, which really is, if we were going to put it in one word, it's unsustainable. We've built for ourselves a very large, very complex system that everybody agrees, whether left or right or wherever they are on the spectrum, has to continue. And yet it's pretty obvious it can't continue. So in this financial sphere, for instance, what we did was we created these wonderful technological products in the financial sphere called derivatives. And what they did, according to Greenspan, was they made risk entirely disappear. So we didn't have to think about risk anymore, which was great because now you can really lever up. And here we are dealing with the aftermath of that. Of course, it was, you want to talk about blowback. This one is we're feeling the first breezes of this storm coming back on our shore. And so we have now this idea here in front of us that we've created for ourselves something that is fundamentally unsustainable just by mathematical definition. Where's the conversation that asks, and by the way, is this something we would even want to sustain?
Oh, well, I came to the whole subject of the lung emergency and, you know, the matrix of oil and resources and money because I was writing in the 90s a series of books about the fiasco of suburbia. You know, that first brought me into this. And, you know, it was my observation that the suburban living arrangement was going to be very problematical for America and, you know, might even, that the venture of American civilization might even founder on it because it was so problematical. But you couldn't fail to notice that we were going to run into a problem with running our system in the years ahead. Even back then, even before guys like Colin Campbell were, you know, writing their first papers in journals.
Well, what were some of those early critiques that you were referring to there that you said suburbia has got a living arrangement that's not worth sustaining?
So I was writing about suburbia back in the 80s and 90s, and, you know, it was self-evident that the whole suburban living arrangement had a range of problems in and of itself that didn't have all that much to do with the sheer energy picture. People experienced it in ways that was hard to articulate for them. You know, they would say things like, there's no sense of community here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and really by that they meant that they were not living in integral urban habitats or even integral rural habitats. You know, they were living in atomized cartoon habitats. You know, the main feature of suburban life the last 40 years is that it became a cartoon of country living in a cartoon of a country house, in a cartoon of the country. And so one of the big lessons that we failed to learn from that, and which actually kind of washes over onto the whole technology and indeed the computer realm, is that the virtual is not an adequate substitute for the authentic. And this goes for the way we inhabit the landscape, and it goes for the way we do business and the way we conduct our money matters and the way, you know, even the way social relations take place. This lesson that the virtual is not an adequate substitute for the authentic is very, very hard for us to learn. And until we do, we're probably not going to get to where we need to go.
You know, everybody who's over the age of 40 can identify with what I'm about to say next, which is that I grew up in what you might sort of think of as a fairly sort of suburban-looking place. Stratford, Connecticut was my earliest years, and I roamed. I was always outside. I was off, me and my friends on the bikes. My mom's, you know, main difficulty every day was getting me to show up by dark or dinner. You know, that was her problem, was getting me in. And nowadays, when I look at suburban areas and you drive around, often it looks like a replica of a place where people live because there's houses. There's actually evidence that there are children there because you might see a swing set. There might even be toys outside, but it almost looks like a neutron bomb went off. There are like no people to be seen. And this is, to connect it all, I guess, you know, we've got our virtual worlds now. There's a lot of reasons why people stay inside and don't go outside. And it's comfortable, and it's an easy existence. And boy, is it so much of my childhood. I'm so glad I lived in a slightly different era because it was really important to me to be out there, outside, roaming around on my own, and, dare I say it, bored from time to time. I think being bored is an essential human condition, which actually makes the brain do wonderful things.
Well, the main problem with suburbia is that it deprived children of this passage through life, where they learn to develop their personal sovereignty. That is, when they learn to manage, you know, how their bodies work in space and in their community and going from point A to point B on their own by themselves and making decisions about how to be responsible to get themselves where they got to go on their own. And once they get there, to do what they got to do when they get there. And, you know, the pattern lately has simply been to overmanage, for parents to overmanage children's lives instead. And I think that that ends up with terrible developmental problems for kids.
Oh, I certainly agree. And letting us all go out and make our own mistakes and roam around is a wonderful thing to do.
You know, also, beyond that, too, you know, the kids need a number of things. They need sort of play spaces where they can use their imaginations that are, you know, not governed by all kinds of rules, especially playground rules, you know. They need wild places and semi-wild places, but they also need the human places and the places of commerce and the places of adult life where they can learn how to take a place in the world. You know, they learn how to buy a popsicle, and that enables them to learn something about money, and then they learn a little bit later in life that they have to earn some money if they want more popsicles. And they see other adults going about their business in a purposeful way. And that's terribly important to see for children, to see adults going about their jobs and their daily lives in a meaningful and purposeful way, rather than just, you know, idling around or sitting in front of a TV eating cheese doodles.
Oh, I agree. You know, this is a question that comes up for me a lot. We just had a weekend seminar at Kripalu, and it's people are very curious, the attendees, about how we're raising our children, and everybody, I think, in any generation always has that question. But ever more so today, it's a really one place where I sense a big gap between what we might say the looming reality and the narrative we're all being asked to live into is this idea that if you peer into the future, it's not hard to imagine a future where you need to be adaptive, creative, really resilient, a variety of descriptors like that. And it's not always clear that we're necessarily raising our children in accordance with those principles, often asking them to conform. And so as I peer into this future, I realize that there's a huge amount of uncertainty in this story that's being developed right now. And at its heart, it's just unsustainable in so many ways. What I can't know and what nobody can know is it's a complex system. Joseph Tainter talks about that wonderful, but we have an increasingly complex and complexifying system that we are slowly throttling for net energy. And somewhere in that story, there's things just don't work like they used to.
And here's something that I've sort of detected as I travel around the country.
Mm-hmm.
There's a clamor for, quote, solutions. Everywhere I go, you know, people say, don't be a doomer, give us solutions. And I've discovered that the subtext to all that is that they really want solutions for allowing them to keep on living exactly the way they're living now. You know, to keep on running Walmart and keep on running Suburbia and keep on running the highway system and the whole kit of parts. And what that really means is that they are looking for ways to add on additional complexity to a society that's already suffering from too much complexity. And so, I'm trying to propose something a little different. Rather than so-called solutions, I'm proposing that we use the term intelligent responses, you know, which is not so grandiose. It doesn't come with a whole grab bag of promises that life is actually going to work out exactly the way you wish. A lot of the intelligent responses that we could be making to our predicament would have a lot to do with decomplexifying and with simplifying. But we don't want to do that. We just want to add more complexity, and that's what some of the wishful thinking and fantasies about technology are all about.
I agree. To me, it's the difference between two words, adapt and adopt. So adapt means that we ourselves are going to change to the changing circumstances, something humans actually are very good at. We are one of the most adaptive species out there. We live everywhere on the planet, right? Obviously, we can do that. But adapting means that we're going to fundamentally modify how we operate in this story. And adopting means we're going to adopt the right and fill in the blank here. We're going to vote in the right president this time or next time. We're going to find the right technology. We're going to tweak the right policies. We're going to do some things that will ultimately, I think, decompose into this statement, allow us not to have to change how we do our own business.
Well, I agree with you. And it's very unfortunate. One of the lessons of that used to be at the center of a liberal education and no longer is that life is tragic. And by that, I don't mean that happy endings are impossible or that bad outcomes are guaranteed. What I mean is that there are consequences to the things that you do, and that everything has a beginning and a middle and an end. And we have to get real with those.
Well, let's talk about ways that maybe we're not getting real. There's been an extraordinary campaign that started about in February that basically summarizes to this headline, the U.S. is heading towards energy independence. And there's been an absolute flood of peak oil is dead, peak oil is over. Whoever they is, have just speared the idea that we have any sort of energy limits whatsoever. And doing it without any trace of irony whatsoever, you know, people who are involved in the oil field say, whoa, 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 whoa. No, there was no new technology that came along. There was no new discovery of this Bakken play. We've known how to frack for decades. We've known how to horizontal drill for decades. What did change in this story? It was the price of oil, right? As soon as oil went over 70, 80 bucks a barrel, it made sense to make those plays, do what we do. And without any trace of irony whatsoever, I'm reading all these gushing stories about how much energy we have without anybody wandering over and saying, hey, let's just see what $100 a barrel oil did to the European economic miracle.
Yeah. Well, obviously, we really want to believe that we're going to be okay with oil. And unfortunately, the authorities in our society want us to believe that. We have been trafficking in untruth and delusion and lies for a very long time. And that has a particular corrosive effect, which is that eventually you cannot trust authority. And, you know, I'm not talking about being authoritarian, but if you're going to live in a civilized society, there have to be authorities that you can trust, you know, whether they're bank managers or political leaders or clergy people or academics. And I think that the absence of the rule of law in money matters especially has corroded the legitimacy and authority of everybody who is supposed to be responsible for stuff. And so what you get now as a result of all of that is a society that can no longer distinguish a lie from the truth and doesn't really much care. And so these places where you never would have thought would be emanating untruth, you know, places like the New York Times. The New York Times published an article, I think about a month or two ago, that said something to the effect that, the United States was on its way to being energy independent.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's unbelievable that the New York Times would do that, the newspaper of record. But that's really how low, our collective sense of truthfulness has gone. And President Obama did the same thing when he got up in a year ago, February, and said, we have 100 years of shale oil. You have to ask yourself, did Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu advise him to say that? And if that did happen, does Secretary of Energy Stephen Chu, you know, the Lawrence Livermore laboratory physicist, does he not understand the energy picture out there? I mean, how can these untruths be generated? The only thing that explains it is a kind of, you know, collective psychological break by everybody in American society, fostered in a climate of the retailing of lies.
That one really caught me when the New York Times came up with it. They were in that general flood, and they said, I believe the headline was U.S. inching towards energy independence.
Yeah, exactly.
But they had a chart right there, which showed that if we did everything right and we kept demand flat for the next 20 years, which has never really happened in the data series, but you know, we're going to do that because we're going to buy the right kind of Priuses or something. But anyway, we keep our demand flat and everything goes like we're hoping in the oil patch, we're going to only be importing 38% of our oil instead of 54%. And I had to go to my dictionary and I cracked it open and I found independence and importing more than a third. Those two things don't line up. And they have good editors at the New York Times. They can pick their words carefully if they choose. How do you square that up? I mean, rhetorically, something's happening there that's difficult to explain through what I would call a normal filter.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm allergic to occult filters, and I'm allergic to conspiracy theories. So I don't think it's that. I think that when I said life is tragic a few minutes ago, what I really meant was this, that societies can make bad collective choices. They just do. Sometimes they choose the wrong path, and history does not shed a tear when that happens. And that's exactly what we're doing. Now, for example, we've been talking about oil, and a lot of that has to do with the whole motoring situation and the fact that we live in this dreadfully car-dependent society. And a lot of people think that the whole question of motoring hinges on the price of the fuel. That how much is the gasoline at the pump? But it's not going to turn just on the fuel. Right now there are two other things that are going on that are going to be equally, perhaps even more influential in determining what happens to mass motoring. And they both have to do with the failure of capital formation. Okay? One is that there are going to be fewer and fewer loans available for people to buy cars. And that's how Americans are used to buying cars, on installment loans. So there's going to be a lot less of that, incrementally. And the second thing is that all governments are broke at every level, the municipal level, the county, the state, the federal government. We do not have the money to keep on repairing and maintaining the elaborate hierarchy of roads that we have developed in the last 100 years. And we're going to be facing a triage process where we have to make decisions about which roads get fixed and which ones don't, and which bridges get saved and which ones don't. I can already see that happening around where I am in the Hudson Valley, where we have a lot of bridges going over the Hudson River and a lot of its little tributaries. And there are some bridges now that are never going to be repaired. They're closed. And, the motoring system has many ways to founder. It's not just going to be a matter of econometrics in terms of, necessarily just the flows of oil and where the oil comes from. There are many things in motion at the same time out there.
Well, ultimately, our capital formation, such as it is what's left over between producing and consuming. And we store that off to the side in this thing called money. And it turns out that as our energy just becomes more expensive, and I don't care if there's an infinite amount of it, if it's $1 million a barrel, we're just going to discover that we have a lot less capital formation going on. It's going to confuse a lot of the conventional economists because they're just assume that capital formation is this magic thing that happens because we're clever. And they don't quite understand that ultimately all of our wealth comes from resources themselves. And we do transform them, and we do very clever things with them. And it's the gap between what we're producing and consuming, and especially in terms of creating a productive infrastructure in some way, to mention, the infrastructure you're talking about, that I agree, it's just going to become more and more difficult. Like, it's going to confuse a lot of people. Like, where's the money? Why are our capital markets not quite working? I don't get it. And they really have to wander over and understand that higher and higher energy prices are very, very corrosive to the idea of capital formation.
It seems to me that the whole capital issue is going to accelerate hugely over the summer. I really don't see how the Europeans can get out of the box they're in, because it really doesn't look like they're going to be able to form a European fiscal union. And it really doesn't look like they're going to be willing to, like the Germans are going to be willing to print money into a hyperinflation. And so I think that the disappearance of money is going to accelerate, and it's going to be all getting sucked into a black hole over the next 6 months. And that is going to be the beginning, really, of a broad-based social awareness of the nature of this problem.
I truly think that people in Greece have already caught on to what's really happening there, and it's very clear that what used to work isn't working anymore. And this is part of my message to everybody, is this idea. It's very easy to model what's you think is about to happen next on what's just happened. And so there's a number of things, I think, working against U.S. interests, U.S. Citizens' interests here, one being the collective sort of overt and covert sort of lies that we tell to ourselves, these omissions and commissions that we do. We leave stuff out of the story. There's context missing all the time from really important parts of our conversation. So you have to fight through the narrative that we're telling ourselves in ways both large and small. And then there's this idea of exceptionalism, this idea that because it hasn't happened yet, and because the United States is you know, X, Y, or Z, however we want to describe it, it really won't happen. So I think the people often have a much lower sense of what the risk really might be. And oh, by the way, you only have to go back to the late 70s, early 80s to go back to a time when it was really dicey as to just how exceptional the U.S. really was. It's even within living memory that these things come and they go. And so the idea that somehow the world leaders, the central banks, the Federal Reserve, et cetera, have really got it all sort of stapled down and figured out, you know, is really a potentially colossal mistake, I think.
Well, we started talking about delusion. And I think it's important to reflect on the idea that the history of the last 200 odd years has been a tremendous departure from human normality. And we think of all the accessories and furnishings of modern life and all of the comforts and conveniences and marvels of it as now having been incorporated into, you know, the matrix of normality, when in fact it's entirely anomalous. And, you know, I had an odd experience the other night. I was driving back from Lake George, listening to a recording of English country dances from the 18th century. And there are these beautiful, elegant and intricate fiddle tunes, basically. And I was trying to imagine the tremendous differences in just the way human beings behaved in that period of time and the kind of people who would have responded to that music. And what their manners might be, and how their social relations might be, and how they would interact with each other so much differently. You know, they would not be wearing sideways hats with their pants falling down, you know.
All right.
You know, my point really is that you said a few minutes ago that human beings are amazingly resilient and adaptable.
Yeah.
And it's true. But cultures themselves go through such massive transmogrifications. You know, human culture changes so hugely from one age to another, that it's almost impossible to put yourself in the shoes or the stockings of those people and imagine what their worldview was. And, you know, likewise, I think that people in the future are going to have trouble putting themselves in our sneakers or our, you know, our highly engineered Nike athletic shoes and imagining what was going through our heads when we were doing this. You know, I mean, I have my own idea about the future, and I think it's going to be a lot simpler than it is now. You know, I think that agriculture is going to come to the center of economic life, at least for a while. I think that we're going to see a major reset in the terms of everyday life and in terms of wealth and in terms of what societies can manage to do for themselves. And I sincerely believe that we are going to see a time out from technological progress as we've understood it in the modern era. And as we have understood it in the modern era, it has been, you know, nothing less than a steady progression of miracles. And I think that we're, you know, that's the reason that we're sitting around waiting for Santa Claus, because we're programmed to believe that we live in an age of miracles, that they're unceasing miracles. It will always be a new miracle following the previous miracle. And we're going to be hugely disappointed by that. In fact, I'd go so far to say that there's going to be a huge reaction, a very negative reaction against science generally and technology in particular. I think people are going to feel hugely let down by technology and science, and that we will probably, as a result, enter a new age of superstition, you know, that will be a rather dark period in American history. And it's already happening. I mean, we can see it in the way that the idiotic religious themes have penetrated American political discourse. So we're really already there.
Interesting. You know, as long as I get my flying car, Jim, it's, you know, I want a flying car someday.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know, that technological Jetson future. I agree with you that there is this sense that technology can triumph over all. When, you know, it was an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal maybe 3 or 4 months ago. They noted that now that the Concorde airplane is gone, and now that we retired the Blackbird, you know, program, it turns out that we hit a peak in terms of airspeed travel. And we're going backwards because it was just, we were at the outer edge, like going faster than a certain, there's a barrier there, and pushing up against it is just really not very cost effective or whatever. And by one version, we would say, oh, no, we will just keep moving faster and faster, and there's no limit to that progress. I was at a conference and I gave a talk, and this guy came up afterwards, and you know, because somebody was saying, oh, Moore's law, you know, we're gonna, you know, look at how fast computer chips now are. And this guy came up and said, hey, here's some calculations for you. You know why we're running up against 3.5 to 4 gigahertz right now? Because that's clocking as fast as the speed of light takes to go across this little 2-inch chip. And sorry, that's the end of that. Once you hit that, we have to find some other way. So we are going to hit these sort of limits that we're going to push up against. And in reaction to that, I see already this idea, I hate to call it checking out or going backwards, but I've seen people, and I interact with them a lot, who've looked into this and said, hey, whoa, time out. I see the direction all of this has gone. I understand the narrative I've been asked to step into. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to have my suburban home. I'm going to have all my gadgets and toys. And something's missing in that. That's not fulfilling. That's not really... yes, consuming is this really awesome thing because we consume iPads, but fundamentally it doesn't set us apart from any other species out there. What is it that really makes us human? And I find people stepping into that story are doing a lot of things like what I've done, and if you'd care to talk about what I think you've done, which is build a lifestyle for ourselves where our actions are in accordance with some of our best knowledge about what's important, the direction the future might be going, maybe becoming a little more resilient, ultimately finding that making sure that our actions and our beliefs or thoughts, when those are lined up, that's where some really magic happens, at least for me.
I agree with you. And I sat out the housing bubble for about 6 years. And then in November, I bought 3 acres of land on the end of a kind of a sad old tired factory village in the Hudson Valley, pretty far up. So I'm right at the edge. I can walk right into town, but I have enough land to grow some food, and I spent the spring building gardens and planting fruit trees and planting berry bushes. And I don't pretend that I'm going to be able to feed myself and my household mm-hmm. off of this, but we're going to be able to eat some out of it. And and there's more we can do. We haven't gone to the chickens yet, but I'm planning on doing that. And so for me, that's been very satisfying. Not everybody can do that, and I was fortunate. And you know, I think that there's going to be kind of a lot of sort of trouble and friction and disorder and people left behind and you know, people who for one reason or another were not able to make any kind of provision like this.
Mm-hmm.
And of course there's no guarantee that we're even going to be able to keep our stuff, you know. If we don't know whether we're going to be living in a very disorderly society even for a period of time.
Right.
So I think that we're trying to walk the walk and trying to live in a purposeful and meaningful way in concordance with reality and with what the future may be bringing us. And it's satisfying to do it, but, you know, life is tragic in that sense, too, that sometimes, you know, the best laid plans of people don't really pan out. So we are very dependent on each other. We're civilized, we're human, we're social creatures, and a lot of what happens in the future will depend on the comportment of our fellow man, even the people in our immediate community.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, these are just periods of change, and we've gone through huge periods of change. There are a few things that are very different in this story at this point, and I know some. I'm currently tracking one big part of this story, looking at a couple things. One, the heat maps, and second, the drought tables, and laying those over our food-producing areas, just wondering how this year is going to turn out. But
What conclusions did you come to so far?
It's shaping up to be a pretty poor year. You know, these things can always turn around, and rain can return, and temperatures can fall. But
Midwest is looking pretty gnarly for the moment.
Yes, yes. There's whole swaths there, and of course we're already seeing that in the futures prices for particularly soybeans and wheat and corn. Mm-hmm. But you know that we're living in an era where, for myself, I've done many of the same steps you've done: a fruit trees, a garden, all this, and it's a quality of life issue for me, and I. At one point, I was entering this life of becoming more resilient because I was a little worried about the future, and I have since learned that actually this is a place I would willingly go to anyway because it's a better place to live my life right now. This is, and I'm fortunate to be able to do this, and I know not everybody can. But for me and my family, I love the lifestyle that's come out of this for me. It's very fulfilling.
Well, I think it's working for you because you used to be kind of a tubby middle-aged guy, and now you look like you're 20 years younger with a six-pack.
It feels better, I'll tell you that. Absolutely. Yeah, and you and I got to see each other at the Slow Living Summit at Brattleboro. That was fun, and we got to have lunch, and it was a great time. So, yeah, you saw me at my worst and my best so far, so hopefully you can continue to see me at the best.
I hope I do.
Well, Too Much Magic is the book. Jim Kunstler is the author. I'm sure it's going to be a fabulous read because all of your writing is just fantastic. Your ability to turn a phrase is really almost second to none. It's great. So looking forward to that. And how can people get their hands on that?
Well, Too Much Magic is at all the usual suspect booksellers. Mm-hmm. But I do urge people to, if they possibly can, get it at their independent local bookstore.
Oh, okay.
Because we do want to support those people. It's very important to give them our business.
Excellent. And that book, it's out now, I take it?
The official publication date was Monday. It's published by the Atlantic Monthly Press.
Okay.
And I think it's also in a Kindle version, which you probably can't get from your local independent bookseller, but just FYI, it is there.
Fantastic. And the blog at Kunstler.com, anybody can visit you there. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it.
A pleasure to talk to you, and I love your podcast every week. It's the first thing that I get excited about, in the cavalcade of weekly podcasts.
Oh, thank you so much for that. I appreciate it.